Good morning, Your Honors. Barry Snyder for the appellant, David Chubb. This is an appeal from a Superior Court decision of Judge Herlihy of December 14, 2007, which was an appeal from an IAB decision, Industrial Accident Board decision, of June 21st of 2007. The case arises out of an accident which occurred on Route 1 in the parking lot by the toll booth. My client, David Chubb, was an employee of the state of Delaware working as a toll collector, and when he left work and went to the employee parking lot, his foot was run over by a coworker, and as his foot got caught, he leaned back and fell and injured his right shoulder. He has been disabled since August 6th of 2003. There is an interplay between personal injury protection, PIP coverage, and workers' compensation coverage. In this particular case, as a pedestrian, the primary insurance coverage was the vehicle which ran over his foot. That coverage was either $15,000 or $25,000. That covered his lost wages and his medical bills. He had two shoulder surgeries, so the medical bills were not insignificant. But that coverage, that insurance coverage, covered him for a period of time. Eventually that coverage ran out because his lost wages used it up. And he then had the option, because he owned a car and had his own PIP coverage, to make a claim under his personal automobile coverage, and that coverage was significant. I can't remember whether it was $50,000 or $100,000, but that coverage then began picking up after about a year and paid his lost wages through the 2 years, and under PIP, there's a two-year limitation on his coverage. In the meantime, two claims were filed by me, one a third-party action against the driver who ran over his foot, and a claim was also made under workers' compensation because the accident had happened at work. The third-party action eventually got settled for $25,000, and after a deduction of a one-third attorney's fees and costs, most significantly the medical reports of Dr. DeShuttle, the surgeon who operated on his shoulder, his net was about $15,500. Additionally, as I said, I also filed a workers' comp claim because workers' compensation provides coverage pretty much into the future without limitation as to years. And given the fact that David was 69 when the accident happened and is now 74, I felt that it was appropriate to file the workers' compensation claim. Initially, that claim was opposed by the insurance carrier. Actually, I think the state of Delaware self-insured, but the administrator, PMA, opposed it, and their attorney opposed it. But eventually, that claim was settled in the sense that a agreement and receipt was filed indicating that they agreed at a minimum Mr. Chubb was disabled from the date of the first surgery, which was October 6th of 2003, approximately 2 months after the accident, through 3 months after the second surgery, which was May of 2004. The first 2 months of after the accident, he was totally disabled, but that was picked up by PIP. After David received his $15,000, I calculated what his weekly wage was, pursuant to the agreement and receipt, and waited the 61 weeks to use that up, because under Delaware workers' comp law, the workers' comp carrier is entitled to a credit for any payments made under a third-party claim. After or towards the end of that period of time, I wrote to the carrier and asked them to start paying the workers' compensation benefit, total disability, and they refused, so a petition was filed, and eventually a hearing was held in which David Chubb testified, the adjuster testified from PMA, and actually not the adjuster who handled the case, but the one who was then assigned to it, and then the two doctors, Dr. DeShuttle and Dr. Case. Dr. Case did two defense medical examinations of Mr. Chubb in the course of the proceedings in the workers' compensation claim. The Industrial Accident Board hearing resulted in a decision against Mr. Chubb, and this appeal resulted from that. The The uncontroverted evidence presented at the workers' compensation claim hearing was that David Chubb had suffered an additional injury, additional permanency, between the time of his surgery, his second surgery, and the time we actually were in front of the Industrial Accident Board. Dr. DeShuttle testified that he had initially given David in October, I believe it was, October of 2004, a 15% disability to his right shoulder and placed certain restrictions on him. When he saw him in October of 2006, he raised that to 20% to his right shoulder. The defense medical exam was done by Dr. Case once in early 2005, and then again shortly after the second report was issued by Dr. DeShuttle. And Dr. Case testified at the Industrial Accident Board that he agreed that the permanency had increased from 15 to 20%, and that he basically agreed with what Dr. DeShuttle had said. Dr. DeShuttle testified that at the second examination, his pain was worse, and he had even less range of motion than before. So there wasn't any dispute in front of the Industrial Accident Board as to what the medical condition was. Indeed, Dr. DeShuttle testified that he had a disability. It was 15%. It had increased to 20%. He had limited use of his right arm and shoulder. He could not do anything overhead, and he also was restricted to light duty with his left hand, his left arm. He's dominant right-handed. He's a right-handed person. He did go back to the state of Delaware when he was released in the summer of 2004 and asked for his job back, but the state of Delaware refused to take him back because of his restrictions. They offered him the opportunity to resign. He refused that because he said he could come back to work, and they fired him at that point because they said he could not do the job. His contention, as testified to at the Industrial Accident Board, was that although he normally did his job with two hands, it was not a significant problem for him to do it with one. He had to take money, and he had to enter information on a screen. He felt as if he could take money with his left hand, and then enter the information with his left hand on the screen. The state of Delaware disagreed with that. The Industrial Accident Board also found that David was not a prima facie displaced worker. And I think that decision is not supported by the evidence in front of the Industrial Accident Board. David, at the time of the hearing, was 73 years old with a 10th grade education. His work history had always been in the nature of blue collar. He had worked with his hands, his arms, his body. He worked in factories, and he had no formal education beyond the 10th grade. And a person with the disability that he had at age 73, with those disabilities, with limited vocational experience in his background, is prima facie displaced in the sense that there is no job for a 73-year-old with those kind of limitations in our job market. He's 7 or 8 years beyond the normal retirement age, and he comes with these limitations on his physical abilities. The Industrial Accident Board, however, found that he was not a displaced worker, and I think that that's clearly a mistake.
Would you remind us of the term of art displaced worker in our workers' comp law? Just what does that term of art mean, and relate it to the facts as you think helpful?
The term comes from a Chrysler case, Chrysler versus Ham, I believe it was, from 25 or 30 years ago. And the concept under workers' compensation is that you can be totally disabled, unable to do any work. That's one part of the concept. That is the clear-cut case. This case is the less clear-cut case, and the case which the Supreme Court dealt with in the Chrysler-Ham decision. And this is a case where someone, because of their age, training, education, skills in the workplace, is unable to find a job in the normal workplace. It's meant for a person who, for instance, a Chrysler worker, who maybe couldn't do the heavy work of a factory job, putting car doors on an assembly line, very heavy work, but perhaps could do something less demanding. And the typical one we find in workers' comp cases is a security guard, someone who's age 45 or 50, who can no longer do the heavy lifting, might be able to go find a job as a security guard in the workplace.
So the concept is basically you treat them the same as if they were totally disabled and couldn't do any work at all, but you do so because the extent to which they're limited, they can't find a job.
Correct.
Okay.
Correct. And so it is a fluid concept. It has to be decided on a case-by-case basis.
Thank you.
Because each case is going to be different. Probably the most significant aspect of this case is the combination of David's age and his work restrictions. If this had happened to him when he was 45, 50 years old, perhaps, with his limitations, maybe he could have gone and gotten a job as, and I'll use the example again, a security guard. But at age 73, it's just unrealistic to expect that he could do that. There is a second aspect to a displaced worker, and that is that if you're not a prima facie displaced worker, you are obligated to conduct a job search and prove that you are in fact a displaced worker because you went out into the marketplace, looked for jobs, and were continuously rejected. And that is where most displaced worker cases end up in disputes. The employee goes out and looks for jobs, says he can't find them. The employer hires a vocational rehabilitation expert and says, I called 10 employers and gave them this person's age, background, work experience, restrictions, and they all said they would hire him. And so that usually is a fact-finding aspect that's performed at the Industrial Accident Board level. In this particular case, our contention is that he's prima facie displaced. So he did not have to go through the job search aspect of it because clearly if he went out into the job market, no one's going to hire a 73-year-old with significant dominant arm restrictions and with his background of no training, no vocation, nothing which would allow him to perform a job which is in the job market.
If you're correct that he's prima facie a displaced worker, that would then shift the burden to the employer to still try to demonstrate that there was available jobs, right?
Correct. That is correct.
And was there any evidence along those lines submitted?
There was no evidence submitted along those lines at the hearing.
Okay. I'm also wondering whether are you making any legal arguments here or are you simply contesting the fact finding? Because if I'm not mistaken, what happened here was that the board said we don't even really need to consider these other issues because we find that there's been no recurrence of your injury.
The board found that there was no either recurrence of the injury or increased disability of the injury, no more significant.
And if that finding was correct, do we get into any of these other questions?
Yes. Then you get into the displaced worker aspect of the case. If you find that the injury got worse from shortly after the surgery through October of 2006, then I think the Industrial Accident Board was wrong in its finding that there were no facts to say he wasn't worse. Both doctors agreed he was worse. He had an additional 5% disability. So you can overturn the case on that basis. Secondarily, if you don't find that, you then go to the displaced worker concept, and you can look at the evidence and say that the Industrial Accident Board was clearly wrong, that you look at the facts, and there is no way that you can say that this man was not a displaced worker, that the hearing officer, the Industrial Accident Board person, made a mistake.
Okay, well, let me interrupt because I'm a little confused here. I thought that the Industrial Accident Board agreed that there was an increase, since both doctors said that there was an increase in his level of permanency, but that the board said, but that's not a recurrence under the law, that, you know, all that is, you know, a modification of an existing injury, and that doesn't qualify. Have I got that basically right or not?
Basically, I think that's right, except that I would add to that that what I think the hearing officer actually said was that there was no increase, there was no change in the work restrictions.
Right.
And therefore, that's what she based it on, no change in the work restrictions. She felt it was irrelevant that he had gotten worse.
What I'm trying to get at is, do we need to be interpreting what it means to have a recurrence, and whether that, whether a continuation of the same injury, but you know, with additional level of impairment would qualify, or is that not on the table here?
I do think that's on the table, that the hearing officer felt that it didn't matter that he'd gotten worse.
Well, counsel, I thought that in the briefing, you know, one of the issues, the legal issue, was whether in order to have a recurrence of a disability, the initial disability has to disappear and then manifest itself again, or whether it's sufficient that that disability simply continue beyond the adjudicated period of total disability. That's what I thought the issue was.
And my contention is that that's not quite the issue. The issue is my client got worse, and therefore would be entitled to the total disability because of the fact that he had gotten worse, which I think is a little bit different than what you're stating.
Well, we're dealing again with a term of art that's almost unique to this area of the law. So
that's true.
Define the term of art recurrence as you see it.
I think a recurrence could certainly be what Justice Jacobs described. You get better, and then for no reason you have the same problem and it's much worse. That is one example of it.
But that's not your position.
But that's not my case, and that's not my position. My position is that my client deteriorated, and therefore that became a recurrence. That made him more totally disabled.
Is there anything out there that defines what a recurrence means?
Not that I'm aware of, not as specifically as I think you're looking for.
So you're saying there's no legal issue? Or there is a legal issue, but the issue is whether if the worker gets worse, that becomes a recurrence.
Correct. And I say that's a factually driven issue, and I say in this case the facts clearly state that he got worse. Both doctors agree.
Well, suppose your client didn't get worse, but his condition remained the same and persisted beyond the adjudicated period of total disability. What would be the outcome in your view?
If my client didn't get worse, right, then I think I'd lose that argument.
Well, you lose an argument based on the fact that he got worse, but if his condition remained the same and didn't subside and then reappear, but just simply continued, you know, as a legal matter, what would be the consequence of that? Would that be a recurrence?
I don't see that as a recurrence. I do not.
You have about 1 minute left. You want to save your time?
I would like to. Thank you.
Good morning. May it please the Court, I'm Kim Harrison, and I represent the employer, the State of Delaware, in this workers' compensation matter. Some of the questions that the panel presented to Mr. Snyder dealt with what is a recurrence, and is there any definition of what a recurrence is. In the Industrial Accident Board's decision, which I believe is attached in the appendix to this appeal, there are several cases cited that define what a recurrence is, and what that is it's a return of an impairment without the intervention of a new or an independent accident. In this case, Mr. Chubb, he was disabled. The carrier or the third-party administrator agreed that he was disabled for a brief period of time. And through a negotiated settlement with claimant's counsel, Mr. Snyder, the parties agreed that that disability had terminated as of the date listed on the final receipt, which was May 11th, 2004. That agreement was reached in 2005, but it was a retroactive closed period of total disability. In order for Mr. Chubb to successfully show that he's had a recurrence, of total disability, he would need to show that without an intervening injury, and there's no dispute that he did not have any new accident or new claim, that he is now totally disabled once again. And from a medical perspective, there was evidence presented at the hearing by both doctors that Mr. Chubb is not totally disabled. Both doctors testified that he can work and that he can work with restrictions. And the doctors were not very far apart in those restrictions that they felt that he had.
What's the significance of both, if any, of both doctors agreeing that at that point his disability increased by 5%?
The term of art, the permanent impairment level is what increased. His increased from an original rating of 15% up to 20%. That is simply a designation or a rating that's been assigned as far as what type of loss of use he has of that upper extremity.
But your point is it has no effect on the term of art recurrence at all?
No. That is our position. It does not have any effect. One can have a 100% permanent impairment of an extremity by having had an amputation, but yet that person is still capable of working. There are plenty of people in this country that work without one of their extremities. They may have restrictions because of that, but that does not in and of itself keep them from being an active part of the workforce.
All right. So as a result of the accident, the worker here was injured and for a period of time totally disabled.
Correct.
And by agreement of the parties, the total disability terminated as of a date certain.
Correct.
All right. Now, under your side's view of the law, what would have to happen in order for there to be a recurrence? And for purposes of answering that question, assume that the worker's medical condition remained unchanged throughout.
In order for the recurrence or for his disability to have begun again, he would have had to file a petition alleging that he is now a displaced worker. In this case, that did not happen.
I'm sorry, we're talking about recurrence here.
Correct.
For there to be a recurrence, is it enough that there be a continuation of the same injury beyond the agreed termination point, or does something else have to happen?
It is the employer's position that it is not enough. If his condition was at point A when he signed the final receipt and nothing changed from that point forward and all other factors remained the same, he would still continue to be a non-disabled person.
What's the relevance then of filing the petition to have him declared a displaced worker?
Well, in this case, Mr. Chubb filed a petition claiming that he was seeking a recurrence of total disability. When the employer receives that petition, what begins is an investigation as to what is his current medical condition. In this case, there was no testimony or evidence submitted that he had had any change in his physical capabilities, which is what the doctors testified regarding. What was not included in the petition but could have been, and what also was not amended prior to the hearing by the claimant, was that he was alleging to be a displaced worker. And there, in the Downs case,
make sure I understand this. So he could, without any second injury, without any increase or in his limits or his restrictions, on the very same facts for which he settled his disability claim, he could now claim to be a displaced worker.
He could, if pled properly.
And the significance of that would be what? What would that entitle him to claim?
By claiming to be a displaced worker,
yes,
with no other change?
Yes.
He would, if he's claiming to be a displaced worker, he would be alleging that he is not employable with his combination of his work injury as well as his other factors that are set out in the Ham case, which are his age, education, background, his work experience. But those are factual determinations for the Industrial Accident Board to look at when they hear the evidence at the at the hearing. And in this case, they met with Mr. Chubb at the hearing. They listened to his testimony, and they also reviewed his age. That was something that he testified regarding. He testified about his employment history, which had consisted of working as an ammunitions worker. He also testified that he worked in an office setting in a chemical company here in Delaware. And then upon his retirement from that position, actually went out and sought a new full-time job as this toll collector job at the state of Delaware. He was beyond the normal retirement age, but the board did not feel that that was a significant factor in determining that he was a displaced worker.
Let me back us up for a minute, because I'm having a lot of trouble with this. As I understand the law, once you reach an agreement on compensation under the under the workers' compensation, you can seek to change that agreement every 6 months, or not less than every six months, if the incapacity of the injured employee has terminated, increased, diminished, or recurred, or the status of the dependent has changed, that the board then has the power to review and modify the award, right?
Correct.
And that would also apply to an agreement, right?
It would depend on what you mean by agreement.
Agreement between the parties. Wasn't there an agreement here as to how long the disability would last and all?
There was an agreement that the claimant had sustained a compensable work accident and that he had injured his right upper extremity. There was also an agreement for total disability filed with the board indicating that he was totally disabled. But by signing that final receipt that was filed with the agreement as part of the settlement, that final receipt indicates that the claimant is no longer totally disabled as of the time he signed that. Otherwise, that would not have been signed. He would have continued to be totally disabled from that point forward.
Well, here's the problem I'm having. If the claimant reaches a settlement and says, I agree, I'm disabled from day one to day 10 or whatever it was, and then comes back and says to the board, I actually want to get more benefits. I believe that I'm disabled for a longer period of time. Doesn't there have to be some fundamental change in his circumstances to even present such a petition?
There would be. And in this case, when he filed his petition for recurrence of total disability, there was no presentation of that change of circumstances. He did not present any medical evidence to support that his physical condition had changed to the point it affected his physical capabilities. And the board was also asked to review the circumstances that one looks at when determining if a person is a displaced worker. And the board did not feel that those applied either, that he did not reach his burden of proof of showing that he was a displaced worker.
Well, those are two separate issues, aren't they? That is, whether or not the workers had a recurrent injury. Even if he didn't, he would still be able to file a petition for compensation as a displaced worker. Isn't that correct?
I think with the term recurrence that we're using.
You're connecting the two, but let's focus, and I think, Justice Berger's question focuses on precisely what is required in order to have a recurrence.
In order to have a recurrence, in the true sense of the word, he would need to medically show that there was a change in his physical condition, as indicated by his doctors, that would cause him to be worse as far as his physical capabilities from the time he signed that final receipt until the time he filed his petition.
And your position is simply an increase in impairment that didn't affect the restrictions on him is not satisfactory.
Correct. He did allege at the hearing, he argued that he was now a displaced worker. Unfortunately, what happens is because that was not pled in his initial petition, nor in the pretrial memorandum, which is required to be filed 30 days prior to the hearing, and also by not amending his paperwork to include that allegation of displaced worker, there was no, he should not have been permitted to argue that as a claim at the hearing.
And that would be because the other side wouldn't have an opportunity to rebut it.
Correct. What happens is if the employee alleges he's a displaced worker and presents even a mild semblance of support for that position, which he could have done successfully in this case by saying, I'm 73 years old and I've pled that I'm a displaced worker, the burden would then shift to the state, or in this case the employer, to show that there is job availability in the labor market for someone with all of Mr. Chubb's circumstances and his physical restrictions. The state was not permitted to have that opportunity here because it was never alleged as part of the pleadings that the claimant filed. The state did object at the hearing to the presentation of that allegation, and the Industrial Accident Board didn't rule on the objection at the time, but in their decision, they included their ruling on it in a footnote that said that they had felt that the objection was moot because they never even found that he was a displaced prima facie displaced worker. What would be interesting is if they had found that he was a prima facie displaced worker, then the burden does shift over to the employer, but yet the employer had never been given advance notice of this allegation, so they didn't have an opportunity to defend and present that proof.
Now, what happens in situations like this? Let's assume you're correct that he either did or could have presented sufficient prima facie evidence that he was a displaced worker. You didn't have notice of that. Does he 6 months from now or 6 months from then get a chance to file that petition with adequate notice, and then do you have to defend it?
Does he have an opportunity to now file a petition alleging?
Is his chance forever gone?
Oh, no, no. Every 6 months, as Justice Berger stated, these agreements and the current status of someone's total disability or their abilities to work can be reviewed.
So even though he could have presented it with timely notice to you, but didn't, 6 months from that petition, he can present one that does give you adequate notice, and you would have to come in and defend. Is that
correct? Certainly. And in there have been previous cases that where the Industrial Accident Board has on their own found that someone is a displaced worker, and yet on appeal that was actually remanded because the employer was never given an opportunity to have a chance to defend against that, so they remanded it so that the employer could get, and they call it a labor market survey.
All right, let me make sure I understand this. Your position is there's no evidence of a recurrence, as that term of art is understood in workers' comp law. So the board was right.
Correct.
On that. Second point is the board was also correct, footnoted or otherwise, that there was insufficient evidence that he was facially a displaced worker. But even if there was some evidence of that, it wouldn't have been appropriate for them to rule that he was, because you didn't have an adequate opportunity to defend against that claim.
Exactly.
But 6 months from that date, or some 6 months from now, whenever, he'll have the opportunity to readdress that with a new petition.
He could, yes.
Does he lose in the interim whatever he might have gained, or is there a retroactive order that could be entered 6 months from now?
Well, what's interesting in this case is that Mr. Chubb is seeking a retroactive decision at the board level that he has had, and he called it a recurrence in his petition, but in theory it's more that he's arguing he's been a displaced worker since the expiration of this credit that he had as a result of his third-party settlement. The problem with that is that the employer, if the claimant is alleging that he has now been displaced, let's say for a period of about two and a half years, how does the employer go back 2.5 years ago and say that there was job availability? How do they address, there's no practical way for the employer to address a stale labor market. The timing is gone. For him to file a petition, it would need to be concurrent with the timing of the filing of the petition.
They don't have a Rolodex with their top 10 answers?
As far as the jobs available?
They can say 2 years ago we had jobs of that kind?
I'm sure that they do. I don't know. Personally, but I'm sure
that's
that
the
they
way lawyers pick doctors
I'm
for
sure
the plaintiff and for the defendant.
I'm sure that they have some type of a database, but to obtain the labor market preparer must come into the hearing room and testify that that person would have been considered for the job at the time that it was available, which in theory is 2-3 years ago.
No, I understand
it
the
would
difficulty.
Be, it would be,
so
it would be
if this worker then were to come in 6 months later and claim before the board that he was a displaced worker, that claim can only operate prospectively. That is, it can't be used as a vehicle to redress a claim that was lost or was forfeited or whatever in the 6 months before. Is that right?
That would be the employer's position, yes.
All right. Going back momentarily to the issue of recurrence, I gather that both the board and the Superior Court made essentially the same ruling. That is, that as a legal matter, there was no recurrence based on the facts of record here. Is that right?
Correct.
What was the precise legal ruling?
From the Industrial Accident Board or both?
Well, the Superior Court, hopefully, and the Industrial Accident Board, hopefully. Yeah.
The Industrial Accident Board found that there was no change in his condition as far as work capabilities, and they found that he did not have a recurrence of total disability. The Superior Court
and recurrence, because recurrence required what?
An intervening injury or a worsening of his condition.
And a worsening of the impairment percentage does not constitute a worsening of one's condition?
They did not find that it did. In the board's decision, the hearing officer did point out that Dr. Case, who testified on behalf of the employer.
I'm sorry, my question is a legal one. Did they find legally that whether his his impairment increased by 5% or 10%, that didn't matter, no matter what the circumstances, or was there some more factually embedded ruling here?
I think it was a little bit more factually embedded, but from a legal perspective, they did not. They did not feel that it was enough to, he did not have an increase in impairment that was enough to count as a recurrence.
Well, are we talking about a sliding scale? If the impairment had been a 10% increase, would that possibly have been enough? Are we talking about numbers or quality?
I want to say it's quality, because what the permanency number, this rating that we're looking at, really means is what percentage of loss of use of that body part does that person have. So again, you can have someone who has 100% loss of use of a leg, but yet has no change in their condition from time A to time B.
Well, before I lose my understanding of this,
okay.
I thought your earlier answer to Justice Jacobs' question would have been the percentage of impairment isn't the focus. The focus is whether or not the restrictions are increased. If you go from a 15% to a 20% impairment, you've gotten worse, but for the purpose of how that restricts you from working, it may be no difference at all.
That's
the
right.
Same restrictions may apply. You still can't lift 20 pounds or more over your head. You're not allowed to participate in the Cirque du Soleil, but there are other things that you can do.
That is correct.
But as long as there's no change in what the doctor says you can and can't do, it doesn't matter that your impairment rating has gone from 15 to 20%. That's what you said earlier.
Correct. The permanency rating does not in and of itself constitute a recurrence, an increase in permanency. I apologize if I wasn't clear. If there are no other questions, I see my
time. Just to follow up on that, if the change in permanent impairment does not qualify as a recurrence in and of itself, what is the defining factor that determines that there is or is not a recurrence?
From a medical perspective, it would be a change in the physical condition as far as, you know, is the claimant now having increased problems with movement? Are they having increased problems with sitting, standing? They could have had a with a lumbar sprain, for example, or actually in this case with an upper extremity problem, he could have had a recurrent tear in the rotator cuff that would need to be surgically repaired. That would be a new problem.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Does it come as news to you that the state takes the position that you could refile, and if if the decision that your client is not a prima facie displaced worker, you could now say he's a displaced worker and here's my, you know, here's the efforts he went through to find a job that were unsuccessful.
My guess is that if I filed such a petition, that the position taken by the state would be that there's res judicata, that either collateral estoppel or res judicata, that decision was heard by the officer and rejected, and other than now my guy's 2 years older, he's got the same condition, he's got the same background.
I thought that the last time around you took the position that he was prima facie displaced and therefore did not put in any evidence of his effort, his unsuccessful effort to find a job.
And that's correct. That is what I believe, and that is what I argued. I lost that argument.
Right, but what I'm asking is, isn't there a difference between taking the position that somebody's a prima facie displaced worker and taking the position that he's a displaced worker and I'm going to prove it?
I still think the state may take the collateral estoppel approach, but I do think I do have the right under the statute to file a new petition.
Well, it would be difficult for him to take that position, as I think Justice Berger's questions pointed out, if it was never adjudicated. It was adjudicated only on the facial displaced worker issue, if at all.
Right, right. I did have one comment on the recurrence.
Well, I'm afraid you're out of time.
I'm sorry.
Thank you, counsel. We'll take the case under advisement and recess.